This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation, please visit our website at zmm.mro.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
This from Master Wu Min's Gateless Gate. Zhao Zhou says, wash your bowls, main case. Once a student made a request to Master Zhao Zhou. I've just entered the monastery, he said. Please give me instructions, Master. Zhao Zhou said, have you had your breakfast? Yes, I have, replied the student. Zhao Zhou said, then wash your bowls. The student had an insight. The commentary. Zhao Zhou opened his mouth and showed his gallbladder and revealed his heart and liver. If this student, hearing it, failed to grasp the truth, they would mistake a bell for a pot. The poem. Because it is so very clear, it takes longer to come to the realization. If you know at once, candlelight is fire. The meal has long been cooked. So we're finishing an introductory retreat this morning. And it was a good weekend, I hope. it was a very nice group, those of you who are here. It felt very mature, not necessarily in the sense that everybody is already a practitioner, but in the sense of being sort of mature people and coming to this with a genuine interest and eagerness to study. Entering the great ways, to examine the great matter, to practice a path. These ways of speaking that are talking about something that is very intimate, very personal, and also very universal. Everybody's lives has a life that is taken up with tasks and activities, things that are to be done, things that must be done, things that are wanting to be done. And so is that what life is? Is that all there is to this? But we might ask, what is the this that we're asking about? We can look out on the world and just say, it's just what it looks like. It's just as it appears. Just have the best experience you can. Hold on to as much as you can. Keep your head down. Or we can look out and deny what we see. This isn't all there is, and I'm going to some other place, some better place, and reject what we see. And some can look out and see the world and wonder, what am I seeing? What am I not seeing? What is seeing itself? In the Prajnaparamita Sutra, the student asks the Buddha, what is the world? And the Buddha says, the skandhas. What we call the world are the skandhas, things. The sensation we have when we come into contact with things, our perceptions of those things, our strategies in relationship to those things, and our consciousness. That's what we call the world, the Buddha said. And so in entering into the study of Buddha Dharma, to see things as they are, to directly illuminate the fundamental, how do we do that? You can't look directly at the sun. It will burn your eyes. When we try and look into utter darkness, it's as though there's nothing there. So how do we look directly at what is true? Right after the Buddha's enlightenment, he said, this Dharma is profound and subtle. It can't be perceived by the senses. In other words, it can't be perceived as the world. And yet, it is nothing apart from this world. And so, Buddhist teachings and practice are all about how do you look directly at what you can't see with your eyes. This koan and koan's practice, koans in the Zen tradition, is a way of doing that. Through inquiry, through your zazen, through engaging the world in what appears initially as phenomena or an ordinary encounter, an object, a question, so that we can go into that and through beyond the eyes, the ears, nose, tongue, skin, and consciousness. This is an interesting koan because in a way it seems so simple, and that should immediately make us more alert. It's also a koan that appears in three different koan collections. In the tradition of Zen, different masters over the centuries gather different stories, different koans, and put them into collections. And so this is one such collection, one of the later ones. And so different masters would collect different koans. And so this koan, and there is some overlap, not a lot, but some, and this koan appears in this collection, it appears in the Book of Serenity, a different school of Zen, and also in Master Dogen's collection of koans that he brought back from China. And what that really means is that different masters at different times saw this koan as important, as being significant. They wanted to include this in their training of their students or in their teachings. And it's interesting because it's so simple. It doesn't use Buddhist language, any particular concepts that are difficult to understand, as other koans sometimes do. The time and place could be any time and place. And it just seems, by all accounts, is just a very ordinary conversation, which is why we should be more alert. In the Book of Serenity, with this case, the pointer says, when food comes, you open your mouth. When sleep comes, you close your eyes. As you wash your face, you find your nose. When you take off your shoes, you encounter your feet. At that time, at just such a time as this, if you miss what's being said, if you miss what's happening, take a torch and make a special search into the deep of the night. How can you attain union? Union is the response to the inner anxiety that every human being feels at being alive. The anxiety of existence, of being, of impermanence, of death. Union is the release from that condition. We could speak of it as a condition because it is, not just because we experience it, but because it is a conditioned experience. It's not the fundamental nature, that sense of separation, of alienation, of disconnect, of somehow living through a screen. We're there, but we're not quite touching the things. The Buddha realized that all of us have Buddha nature, enlightened nature, whether you like it or not. It's just our fundamental nature. It's an awakened nature. It's a miraculous awareness, Bodhidharma said. And so within that very place, this student enters into the monastery of the great master Zhaozhou. He was a great sort of luminous teacher within the Chan tradition, Zen tradition in China. He lived, he started, he came to enlightenment, his first realization when he was 18, just a young person. He studied with his teacher, Nanquan, for about 40 years. Continued on at that monastery after Nanquan's death for about another 20, I believe. And then he went on a pilgrimage at the young age of 80. Settled in the town of Xiaozhou, where he took on his name and taught until he died when he was 119. And so this student, and was really a student all his life. And so this student is just entering the monastery. And he says so, and he says, please give me instructions, Master, teach me. He's asking for the teachings. He's not afraid to ask. It sounds easy, it seems easy, and yet it isn't necessarily. Not for many of us. In one sense, we have to acknowledge all is not well. I don't have it all under control. Right? I don't have all the answers. In fact, as we look, we may find out we have very few answers. We have lots of information, lots of knowledge. And so these are very powerful words. Please teach me. You know, it's interesting how some students will come into face-to-face teaching and talk about their experiences, about dreams, about their things that have happened, about their views on things and so on, and leave without asking a question. And if I interrupt to try and pull something out, sometimes they get upset. Well, wait, let me finish. And of course, that can be an important part of training, to speak, to be heard, to clarify something within oneself. When I was studying, I was more familiar sometimes than I wanted to be with the stories in my mind. I wanted to know, what does my teacher have to offer? Sometimes I would ask questions that I already had some sense of myself, but I wanted to know, how do you see this? Please teach me. Xiaozhou says, have you had your breakfast? An old master says, because it is so very close, it takes longer to come to realization. Because it is so very simple, it can be so difficult to see. But simple here doesn't mean obvious, simplistic, superficial. Simple means unadorned. It means profound and subtle and difficult to see with our ordinary ways of seeing. Not able to understand with our ordinary ways of understanding. And that's why one reason Zazen is so important is because we're learning how to trust another aspect of our consciousness, which is not the result of a thought process. It's not the holding up of an idea or an opinion. It's not having established something and then setting out to prove that that's true or get somebody else to agree. It's setting out asking, please teach me. I want to know, I want to understand. In the Prajnaparamita Sutra, the Buddha speaks about the suchness of all beings, the fundamental reality present in this and every moment, the union of all dualities, present, alive, unobstructed. He says the suchness of Buddhas and all beings are one single suchness, an indistinct suchness. Because it's indistinct, it is indistinguishable, and because it is indistinguishable, it is undivided. It's not separate from anything. How can you attain union? I'll tell you how. You can't. You can't. To attain union means that from the beginning, we are not. We are divided. We are distinguished. We are distinct. And that the Buddha realized that is our delusion. That is the perception that we have that gives rise to every form of suffering. And so we are challenged from the very beginning of encountering the Dharma with the fundamental revolution. It ain't so. And to practice on the basis of that fundamental truth, which we don't yet know to be true, we may long for it to be true, we may long to have experienced that directly, but the better part of us doesn't believe it. We are distinct, we are different, we are divided. And we could ask the question, how's that working? Because, as I said yesterday in the group, Buddhism is an evidence-based tradition. And so if living a life based on the notion of divided, distinct, separate, not union, everything should be working quite well. The fact that it's not in so many areas of our life and our world is because the evidence that something is not true. Something about all the ways we're doing our lives, our world together, is based on something that is not true. It's not working. And so here this student asks a question, comes seeking. It's like shooting an arrow and then waiting for something to come back, sending out a message and waiting for an answer. Please teach me, he says. And when we do that, normally we expect the answer, we ask in a certain language, and we expect the answer to come back in the same language. We're asking from a certain frame of mind, and we're expecting the answer to come back from that frame of mind. At the same time that we're wanting something new. We're expecting it to affirm our view at the same time that we may sense that that view itself is binding. Here, Xiaozhou sees the student, somebody who is already complete and sufficient. And in a sense, by asking that question, is stepping away, but still needs to ask. And so he redirects the arrow back home. Have you had your breakfast? Sometimes in these encounters, the language, the response comes in an unknown language. Not recognizable. A shout, a strike, putting sandals on the head. Forward 3x3, back 3x3. Yunmen's a shit stick. All of these different responses using language. A foreign language, it would seem. Sometimes the response comes back in such plain, ordinary language that it goes unheard. We don't hear it. And another time, a student asked Master Xiaozhou, I've just entered the monastery. Please teach me. Xiaozhou said, good heavens! And walked away. And his old master once said, he wasn't being kind-hearted. You know, he wasn't trying to be clever. He was trying to open the gate, to break the sky. Have you had your breakfast? Asking the question, we look out, we look away, we wait, we hope, we expect. Something. And so, at that time, if we don't hear what's being said, take a torch and make a special search in the deep of the night. In that one moment, have you had your breakfast? One moment, one encounter, nothing outside. What is it? What was Xiaozhou trying to show him? An old master said, stop and see. Stop and see. He couldn't have known how much he was speaking to us in our time, to stop. Not an easy thing to do. You know, distractedness is not just a sort of random, obsessive flowing of thoughts. There is thinking as a meditation. There is mindful thinking. But that's not what most of us do. To think mindfully means we have to train. We have to reclaim that capacity of our mind. That within thoughts, we are in a state of concentration. But distractedness is more than that. It's like the deep restlessness of being. It's like the incessant tapping of the foot. When my father first time came to visit after I'd been here quite a number of years, he would not come into the zendo. He arrived at exactly 11 o'clock. We were already in here. The talk was beginning. My teacher was sitting right here, and he appeared. I couldn't see him, but I could hear him. Of course, I was expectant. And throughout the whole talk, he wouldn't sit down. He leaned against the wall and jingled the change in his pocket. And I thought, that pretty much sums it up. His dis-ease, and I love my father. He was a wonderful person in many ways. But I could feel his discomfort. I could feel his dis-ease. And it wasn't just being here. It's a mind occupied with unreal thoughts, past, present, future. Things that are no more, things that have not happened, may never happen, and things that are just simply not what we think. It's hands, arms, legs, fingers, moving in different directions, not unified, not connected, not one body. And so we train, we practice. How do we attain union? How do we rediscover our fundamental union? One moment, one practice, one awareness, the radical leap into one true thing that is never anywhere else. And to do that without the desire for profit or fame or recognition or accomplishment. Ultimately, not for any purpose and not with any meaning. Why have trust in such a path? We devote so much of our time to all of those things, to acquiring, producing, keeping. And yet, we sense that there is something missing. Evelyn Underhill, in her book on mysticism, which is kind of a remarkable piece of work, was written quite a number of years ago. She said, even the most ordinary human life includes in its range fundamental experiences. And she's talking about what we might call spiritual experiences, things that are hard to explain, but we know that they're true. She describes them as sometimes being violent and unforgettable, violent in the sense of their power, of the way they unsettle us, of the questions they raise, of the disturbance that they create in our attempt to have a settled, sort of domesticated world. And she says, which are forced on us as it were against our will and which science finds it hard to account for. She says, these experiences and sensations in the hours of exalted emotion, high and low, which they can bring, which can be sometimes recognized as the most significant times of our lives, fulfill no office in relationship to functions of nutrition and reproductions. What she's talking about is we're biological beings. We need food, we need shelter, we need water. That's what we need to live. But as human beings, it seems that we don't just need that. We need other things that in a certain sense we can't logically account for. She says, it's true that they're far-reaching in their effects on our being, but they do little or nothing to assist that character in its struggle for physical life, which is one reason it can be so hard, left to one's own, and within a busy life, to remember that this is important. Because the things that are furthering our struggle or our physical life, taking care of the things of the day, are so clearly important and necessary. And so that's one of the great challenges of actually having a practice, of walking a path, is continuing to not just remember, but cultivate and strengthen not just the memory, but the known sense, the conviction, as my teacher said, the imperative, that our life is not just a physical life. She says, amongst the more intractable of the things that we experience are those things that we connect or associate with religious practice, with pain, and with beauty. Interesting. She says, all of these, for those cells which are capable of receiving their messages, possess a mysterious authority far in excess of those feelings, arguments, or appearances which they may happen to contradict. She said, many people consider such things absurd or unnecessary. They don't provide us with physical life. She says, I need not point out that, and so she does, the hopelessly irrational character of all the great religions, which rest one and all on a primary assumption that can never be intellectually demonstrated, much less proved. And that is that that which we experience beyond our ordinary rational thinking mind is somehow important and real and is intimately connected with the life of the person. And so how do we remember this? How do we bring this forward? And that's one reason, you know, that how we live our lives is really going to help us or not. You know, that's why having time, having space, such as we create here, such as we create during a weekend, such as this, where we can turn our attention to such things within ourselves. Because I have never seen it happen that when somebody does that, when they make contact with that within themselves, that they get up and walk away and say, that's not important. I have never seen that happen. I have many times seen people come back or return having forgotten that that's important. And through the course of a day or a weekend or a week, make contact with that and then know again how important that is. And sometimes leave with anxiety that they will forget. This is a real thing. And because ultimately it's not about accumulation, producing, acquiring, when we're anxious and have been so conditioned to make our lives about that, those things can eclipse this, in a sense, much more subtle aspect of our being. Please teach me, I've just entered. Have you eaten your breakfast? Dr. Roshi says, if your potential does not leave in the koan, in the Shobogenzo, Dogen Shobogenzo, his commentary says, if your potential does not leave its fixed position, you will sink on dry land. The moment there's affirmation and denial, the mind is lost in confusion and we fall into grades and stages. In other words, we're not going to figure this out. The koan, life, our unhappiness, our discontent, If it could be figured out, we would have done it. We know how to figure things out. We are really good at that. We are, I mean, really, let's admit it, right? Let's give ourselves that credit. We are really good at figuring things out. There's a whole universe that can't be figured out. It's not like that. And it's this universe. Have you eaten yet? Yes, I have, the student says. Zhaozhou says, then wash your bowls. Zhaozhou realizes he didn't understand. He didn't hear him. He heard the words. But really what he heard was his own ordinary mind, his own conditioned mind. He heard a familiar language that was affirming what he already knew. The teaching was given, but it wasn't received. And so he says, wash your bowls. The Book of Serenity says, opened up, the mind ground meets itself. It says the student had an insight. He saw something. In one of the commentaries, the teacher says, he had an insight. It was not very deep. How did he know? But that's not really a concern, because it's not about falling into grades and stages. It's a path. In that one instant, the 10,000 things return to the one, and that one contains the 10,000 things perfectly. Another time, a student asked Master Zhaozhou, I've just entered the monastery, please teach me. And Zhaozhou said, you have entered. Anything more than this is confusion. Just enter. The moment you start looking beyond confusion. Master Dogen says, ordinary mind means to maintain this mind in this world and every world. Everything comes forth from this place. When you go with this mind, the whole sky goes with you. When you come with this mind, the whole earth comes with you. Attaining union, not divided. And maintaining, as Dogen speaks of it here, means to begin here. You know, we're so conditioned to think, it's like when I was a musician, I would practice and practice and practice for a performance, for a recital, right? For an audition. But every moment that I was practicing, I was playing music. But in my mind, I was doing something for this. This was preparation. This was the fruit of that preparation. That wasn't true then. And it's not true with this. In each and every moment, we have arrived. In each and every moment, it is here. In the beginning, everything seems distant. Everything seems dim. The breath, the body, the mind, the Dharma, the teachings. Maybe it's just a testimony to our inherent desire to be alive, truly be alive, that within our distractedness, within that, that there are moments where things actually enter in and they go deep. Where we do actually encounter something fundamental and we know it, we can't explain it, but it awakens or it reaffirms, it guides, it pulls us in. How many times have I been speaking to somebody here and they're here, they brought themselves here and they say, I don't know why I'm here. Can you tell me? I don't know why I'm here. What am I doing here? I'm not the kind of person who comes to a place like this. And yet their feet brought them here. But their feet were just doing what something was telling them to do. Thank goodness that we trust that, at least now and then. But in that dim and distant place, as he says, it's easy to mistake a bell for a pot. They both look kind of similar, but they're not the same. It's easy to be fooled by a thought, by an emotion, by an idea, by a desire, by a situation, by another person, by our projections. In a sense, that delusion is being fooled a lot. Not consciously, not, you know, with ill intention, but just simply because things are not yet fully clear. And so recognizing that, we come to the cushion, we return to the cushion day by day, moment by moment, developing, maintaining that mind, bringing it forth, strengthening. You know, we can't just decide that we're going to transform our lives, having lived our life in a particular way, not just for this life, but for generations, and inheriting legacies of others' unexamined lives, and then expect that just by a desire or a decision or by will. I mean, it's really no different than picking up a violin and saying, I'm going to, with my first note, play a masterpiece. I mean, we wouldn't do that, right? We know, like, that's not quite realistic, right? That's not going to happen. You actually have to practice. Why do we think? Why would we presume that somehow we can just glide in, you know, meander around a bit, and then glide out, enlightened? I mean, maybe just, I mean, we're conditioned to think that we can get things like we want, but really maybe because we don't really understand yet. How could we? I didn't. What we're really about, what all this is about. And so we return again and again. Stop and see. Zhaozhou says, wash your bowls. Apart from this, there's not a single thing. And this not a single thing includes all things. Dogen says, this very mind opens the gate of the inner chamber. And in that, we hear an unrecognized voice, a voice from the deep that is all-inclusive. There's a very wonderful story here of a master who is walking with his student. And they're walking through the woods, and the master says, can you smell the fragrance of the moksai tree? Can you smell the fragrance of the flowering locust? And the student said, yes, I can. And the master says, I have nothing to hide from you. We should examine that. Do you smell the fragrance? Yes, I have nothing to hide from you. Nothing is hidden from you. And yet, sometimes we mistake a bell for a pot. Where is the confusion? The bell is not confused, the pot is not confused. But to understand that this confusion is just part of human life. Part of it as a result of our conditioning, how that mingles with our consciousness, and not examining. And so the Buddha Dharma, this path, is a path of examination, but in a new way, a different way, a radical way. The most radical part of it is that from the beginning you already know. It's like you walk in to take a class, eager, and the teacher says, you already know everything about this, and they walk out. And because we would just sit there, right? You may say so, but it doesn't seem like it from over here. Please teach me. Return to the cushion. From the beginning, you are this way, I am this way, and yet there is so much pain and confusion. And so there is a path. There is practice. There is a way. It is free of success and failure, so you need not bring that along with you. When you do, you will know, because you will feel the pain of that. It will show itself as frustration, as disappointment, as competitiveness. And in that moment, trust, your practice is fine. Just give up the grade, the rank, the standard, the measuring. Trust there is another way. This path doesn't belong to anyone. You can't buy it. You can't sell it. You can't corrupt it. We can practice it or not. We can practice it well or otherwise. The door is always open. And what we begin to see, what we really need to see, is how utterly responsible we are to ourselves and to each other. You know, we can establish a schedule. 9 o'clock, the dentist show rings. It's time to come in for service. But no one can make you chant a sutra with your whole body and mind. No one can make you bow to the Buddha and relinquish the self. No one can make you let go. No one can make you yearn towards what is true. And we realize how responsible we are to ourselves. And that's a wonderful thing, because it means that every moment we're empowered. And it also can be a daunting thing, because at every moment it's up to us. But if you abandon the success and failure paradigm, because that's not this, then you're free to start over, over and over and over again. You know, it's like we can turn our backs and walk away. I'm done. I don't want this, right? But the Dharma will never spit on you or turn its back on you. It's not a thing. It doesn't have a door. That's why Wu Men named this collection of koans the gateless gate. These koans seem formidable. How do you enter? They seem to present you with a locked gate. And so just to make sure, he says, the gate is gateless. It appears so. It's not so. And so for each of us to listen to that voice from the deep, those unrecognized words, and to realize that once you know that candlelight is fire, when we see things as they are, then you know all along the meal was cooked and ready. An old master wrote a poem. Do not think the moon appears when the clouds are gone. All the time it's there, so perfectly clear. That's your nature, it's my nature. As practitioners, all of us possess that equality. But it is important to know that we come into the Dharma differently because of our karma, because of the world we live in. Some of us entered into this world and we were welcomed. We have a table waiting for you. Please come over. Others of us came in and we were not so welcomed. Some have had paths opened and guides along the way, some not. None of those things prevent us or diminish in any way that essential nature that we all possess or our capacity to realize it. But what it does is it presents us with this self, the one that each of us brings forth to the Dharma. And that's what our practice becomes. And those very challenges also, importantly, become the ways by which we work certain things out. You know, we want to just sort of get rid of the difficulties, the challenges, past and present, so that we can practice free and clear. We learn, we discover free and clear by practicing what is here. There is no other way. And so we do have to have the courage to turn towards that, but also to learn what does that mean? How do we do that? How do you do that skillfully? Well, and so to practice with others, to study, to ask for the teaching, all of these things are important now. They were important in the time of the Buddha. That doesn't change. And so for those of you who are perhaps starting out or still finding your way, I just encourage you to keep doing that, whatever brought you here. Keep feeding that. Dogen said, consider it as like holding a baby in your arms. It's vital, it's life, it's alive, it's vibrant, but it's fragile, right? It's tender. It needs attention. It needs attention. So. You know, we can see how in our own lives we need this, and that's true. The fact of the matter is the world needs this. The world needs you and me to be awake. Is there any doubt? And so in that, your practice is not just your practice. Anything you do, all that you do, is affecting this world. And so why not be instruments, agents, bodhisattvas of bringing illumination?
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.mro.org.